I was going to be over there talking just now tonight, but we have some very late breaking news that I think I should probably do from here, because we would have done this in the monologue if we had known. It literally happened while we were doing the show, while we were taping. I'm not entirely sure what I'm about to say. Here's the deal. After his big tariff announcement this afternoon, President Trump came on. Did he come on air and do this or release? How was this? How did we find out? He announced it in front of the White House. He said that there was going to be big news on North Korea, and we just got it.
A big news on North Korea that Stephen Colbert interrupted his late show for yesterday is that Trump agreed to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after an official invitation from the supreme leader there in North Korea. If the meeting really does happen, it'll mark the first time any American president has ever met with the head of North Korea. The two leaders have never even spoken on the phone. Kim reportedly told South Korean diplomats that he is eager to meet President Trump, quote, as soon as possible. So, could this actually happen? What would it mean for international relations moving forward? David Kong is director of the Korean Studies Institute over at USC. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So the U.S. and North Korea, they've been longtime adversaries, repeatedly threatening each other. There was Trump saying he had a bigger nuclear button than Kim Jong-un, called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, some pretty heated fire and fury comments. Why the sudden shift, do you think?
Well, I think certainly North Korea has had a methodical plan in place, and they've done over the last year. They've done the test, then they met with the South, and they've moved forward with an opportunity to lower the temperature. And I think this president decided to take a chance. And so it's a pretty breathtaking chance by Trump, but I think it's a way to move forward.
Is this successful for the president, by the way?
You know, I think it is, right? We have been, for the last year, worried about whether a war would break out, either over there or with missiles dropping here. So if you don't want a war to break out, let's see what diplomacy can do. I don't think anyone is naive and thinks that this first step is going to solve the nuclear crisis, get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, and we will then, you know, drop our sanctions. That's naive. But as a way to lower the temperature, as a way to find some concessions on both sides and find a modus vivendi, I think this is the way forward. If you're going to have a negotiated solution, you have to start negotiating at some point. So let's see what happens.
That's the way forward for the United States and for President Trump. What's in it for Kim Jong-un, do you think? What does he get out of this?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, there will be an endless debate about whether the current maximum sanctions and pressure forced him back to the table. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But clearly, the North Koreans have always craved legitimacy, to be treated like other countries. And Trump giving this type of status to Kim Jong-un is a massive psychological or you know, cultural boon to the North Koreans. They have always wanted to be treated as equals. So maybe that will work. Maybe that will be something that Kim is willing to trade a lot away for.
If you were on the president's team and you were advising him on how to prepare for this meeting, and who knows who's going to be going with him. I know the State Department has a thin roster in its personnel, right? There aren't a whole lot of people who can do this.
No.
What would you tell him? What would you recommend the president say to this leader?
I think there are two things that both sides need to develop. And I think this is where something dramatic like this, for decades we've been patiently waiting out North Korea and working at the lower levels, and it never works. If it's a personalistic dictatorship over there, if our president can set up something where there's a working relationship, talking at the highest levels might actually set up a way that the two sides can talk. That's number one. Number two, I would say that our side needs to go in very clearly having an idea of what we are willing to give in a stepwise process in order to get them to give up their nukes. Is it a peace treaty? Is it end of sanctions? Is it open economic ties? I mean, we need to have a good idea about what we're going to give and what the steps are going to be.
Can I underscore the fact that there is just an armistice between South Korea and North Korea, right? That there really was no formal end to even the war back in the 1950s.
No, there isn't, right? And so we are sort of formally in this, and an armistice is literally just a freezing in place, right? So there are a lot of lower level initiatives that both sides can take short of full diplomatic relations and a denuclearization. There are a lot of steps we could take to begin to manage the problem in ways better than we're doing now. And I think that's the realistic goal, is to do something like that in the short term.
What about the risks going forward? There have got to be a lot of risks here.
Sure, there's lots of risks. You know, we were just, but I want to point out, for the, you know, the amount of skepticism I have heard about this in the last day, and I say, you were just worried about the risks of war. Now you're talking about the risks of diplomacy. Of course there's risks. The question is, what are the alternatives? So the risks in this case are that they go and they both get mad at each other and they start yelling and, you know, something like that, right? I actually think that's going to be very low, because if we stop looking at Kim Jong-un as a cartoon, and we actually look at what he's doing, the guy is a very sophisticated diplomat. He's very self-assured. He's confident. I think he has plenty of social skills. And I think Trump, if I had to predict, I think Trump is going to come away saying, I like that guy.
Well, he was educated in Europe, right?
For a while, yes.
Yeah.
And they're clearly not out of touch. The South Korean diplomats, when they were at the summit meeting with Kim last week, were watching South Korean TV in their hotel rooms. I mean, this is not an isolated regime the way we think about it. They know what's going on. And my guess is that Kim is probably going to play to Trump in the way that many other leaders have done it. And I think Trump, you know, will probably enjoy going back to him. And certainly this is going to make everyone's head spin around if they begin to get along. And so we'll see, right? So the risks are high, but also the upside is potentially massive.
David Kong, director of the Korean Studies Institute over at USC. David, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, let's get a little local perspective right now, and we're going to turn to Jun Bong, who is director of the Korean-American Coalition based here in Los Angeles. Of course, L.A. has a large, very large Korean population. Hi, Jun.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. The reaction from your group today on this, I mean, this is big, big news.
It is big news, and I think it's certainly welcome news, especially with the rhetoric that's been going on between North Korea and the United States for the past year, and just coming off the heels of the winter Pyeongchang Olympics. This is really welcome news.
What are you hearing in the community that these two leaders will, I mean, for the first time, an American president and a North Korean dictator leader?
Yeah, there's a sense of optimism, but I think it's a little tailored with some caution. So it's cautious optimism here.
How do South Koreans in L.A., June, feel about Trump? Do they like him? Do they? Well, I mean, because he has made inroads, it seems, at least in dealing with the South Koreans, and has been much tougher on North Korea, at least in his language and in the tweets that he's made.
Yeah, I think the sentiment within the Korean American community here in L.A. is probably very similar to other communities here in L.A. too, like the Latino community or other ethnic minority communities. I think we all kind of share the same sentiment in terms of the effects of President Trump.
You mean as far as immigration goes, as far as people feeling castigated because they're from somewhere else and not America? Is that...
All of the above.
Really?
All of the above. But, I mean, this is a different tone. I think we had a lot to feel anxiety and fear last year, especially when the president was talking about going to war with North Korea and the things that he would potentially do.
This is the fire and fury, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So given all that for an entire year and then coming to a place where there could be an opportunity for peace, it's a big deal.
Let me turn it another way, June, because do you think maybe there are concerns that the president will somehow maybe not have the assist that he needs from the State Department, because it is woefully, right now, there are not a whole lot of personnel there to help him along these
right.
lines, right?
Yeah.
But also that maybe that he will botch the meeting somehow and upset Kim Jong-un and make the U.S. relationship even worse with North Korea.
I hope that doesn't happen. If anything, you know, the president has touted himself as the consummate deal maker. So let's hope that he's able to pursue negotiations that benefit the world.
Was it weird, do you think, that the South Korean delegation was the one that announced this in the first place? It wasn't the White House. It wasn't Sarah Huckabee Sanders. It was the South Koreans actually came out of the White House and announced this.
It's definitely weird, but it's also weird that there isn't an American ambassador to South Korea at the moment, too. So, and that might be one of the reasons why it wasn't the White House presenting this to the public. It was through the South Korean government. But also, I think the efforts from the South Korean government with the new president, Moon Jae-in, I think that's the deciding factor, and I think that's why we're able to look forward to conversations between North and South Korea in April and then and possibly the summit, too, in May.
What do you think gets the bigger reaction, June? Is it the fact that Trump has been so vehemently, I don't want to say hostile, but has obviously had some harsh words, calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man on Twitter, and you know, the U.S. military has been looking at maybe a bloody nose policy to try and, you know, maybe hit North Korea first. Is that important in the Korean neighborhoods here in Los Angeles, mainly of South Koreans? But, I mean, do they applaud that as opposed to feeling isolated as immigrants, people who are in this country who may not like Donald Trump personally?
Yeah, I think the sense that we get is that type of language where it's provoking war or promoting war is really out of touch with our community.
They don't like that. They, even to the north, even saying, you know, North Korea, this is, you know, ardent, obviously a big nemesis to the south.
Yeah, I mean, for North Korea, I would think that they would use all that war rhetoric for their propaganda and just leverage that to continue to promote, you know, war against the United States. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make sense from our point of view. And this isn't just like a Korean-American thing. It's just, it's an American thing to be witness to that type of rhetoric about, you know, going to war and potentially killing thousands of innocent people.
On the Korean Peninsula, not to mention elsewhere.
Right, and we're not just talking about South Koreans. You're also talking about Americans who live in South Korea, too. I mean, it'll be devastating, the concept of war on the peninsula. It would be catastrophic.
June Bong, director of the Korean American Coalition here in Los Angeles. June, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up, rain is in the forecast. Can you believe it? This weekend, later next week too. But is it enough, or will the grip of drought continue? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis on a Friday, in for Madeline Brand. After a very dry winter, but a wetter past couple of weeks, more rain is on the way. Forecasters are predicting a good chance of the wet stuff through the weekend and once again later next week. The National Weather Service says LA could see a third, maybe a half inch of rain, while the mountains could get upwards of 2 inches or more. And the rains have Californians hoping for a March miracle that could save the state from falling too far back into drought. But the Federal Drought Monitor, as of this week, says California is still unseasonably dry, with nearly half at least in moderate drought. Now, one of our go-to folks over at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, is Bill Patzert, and he joins us right now. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
So what is causing this swell of rain in the forecast this weekend and beyond? Are we getting more unsettled here?
Well, you know, what we're having is this Saturday evening, we're going to have a nice little storm coming in from the south. I don't think it'll be a huge rainmaker, but it'll help. But next week, it looks like we have the real deal, a slow-moving storm out of the North Pacific that could linger for a few days midweek. So beware of the Ides of March.
The Ides of March. All right, here we are in the working our way toward the middle of March. Is this some sort of March miracle? Are we getting good luck from St. Paddy?
Well, you know, I think for miracles, I usually go to the Old Testament. There is no real miracle here in store. You know, we're pretty deep in the hole. Usually December, January, and February, we get about 9.25 inches of rain.
How much have we gotten?
So far, we've had 1.8 inches of rain.
What is that, downtown L.A.?
Downtown L.A.
Yeah.
So We're only at about 22% of normal for the rain season. So even if we had heavy rains continually through the end of March, that would not make up the deficit. And you know, here in Southern California, when we get heavy rain, most of it ends up in the ocean anyhow. So it would be good for the snowpack, but, hoping for miracles, that's a stretch.
The Federal Drought Monitor, Bill, said this week that nearly half the state, this is 47%, is experiencing at least moderate drought. And for the first time I saw the map, there's a little tiny red area in parts of L.A. and Ventura counties. This is extreme drought. We haven't seen that in more than a year. And here we are back into this notion that it's really, really dry. What would we need? Now, you said like system after system after system, we would need to get out of this drought. Is it possible? Is it possible to erase this?
Well, you know, I think of droughts as they're long. It takes a long time to get into a drought. You crawl into it slowly and you ease out of it even more slowly. You know, really for the last 20 years, we've had 14 years of below normal rainfall. And so we've been talking on and off drought here for a long time. And so I don't think of a quick fix for the drought.
I know that we went from, what, single-digit percentage of snowpack, water content, right, in the snowpack up in Northern California, correct, of average, to 37%, I think, the last go-around at the beginning of March. So that was an improvement, even though it's still pretty low. Maybe this time in April we'll see something better, do you think?
Well, what happens here, if we look at the bigger picture, Steve, is that California, like the rest of the world, is warmer. And so the snowpack in California, it comes later on average, and it leaves earlier. And so I always think of this as we're headed into a sort of a semi-permanent drought. And so we have to redefine the definition of drought.
Are you saying climate change is causing this?
Climate change is having a big impact on the snowpack, which is historically been really the saver in terms of, especially for Southern California, for our water supply.
What about all those reservoirs that are still pretty full from last year's wet season? Obviously it's good news. If you're going to be in a drought, I guess it's good to have the reservoirs full, right?
Oh, absolutely. Last winter, it was really a blessing filling up all those reservoirs. And you're correct, they are full. But I don't see water districts here in Southern California removing any of their conservation mandates here anytime in the near future. We're in a permanent conservation mode here. So, think more, use less.
Right, and to be sure, these water conservation measures could be permanent. They could be codified in California in the coming weeks by water officials all across the state. I know that last year, because of the very wet winter that we had and the snowpack that was, what, 180% of average or whatever it was last year in the Sierra Nevada, that a lot of state officials declared that the drought was over. Do you think it was too soon? It was premature to do that?
Yes, I think it was very premature. If you look at a big source of our water here in Southern California are the groundwater basins that sit beneath Southern California communities, and they remain very, very low. I know here in the San Gabriel Valley, it's almost a crisis. So there is no March miracle, and I want everybody to think continuing drought and conservation.
You're a climate guy, right? Long term, you say this is the new normal, that it's just going to be drier. This is, maybe with a few years in between that we have really wet winters, but we're just trending drier. Is what do you tell people if you're talking at a dinner party and they say, Bill, what should we be doing? What do you tell them?
Well, the population of California in the last half century has quadrupled. whereas the population of the United States has only doubled.
So you're saying they should leave then? People should just leave California?
No, absolutely not. There's plenty of water, Steve. There's plenty of water, all right? But we're living in a semi-arid climate and with tremendous demands on the water, both from urban users, agricultural users, and industrial users. And so we just have to manage our water more intelligently, and that means conservation.
Bill Patzert, our climate expert over at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Bill, always nice to have you on.
My pleasure. Enjoy the rain.
You may not, however, enjoy the critters.
Wesley, what about the RUSs?
Rodents of unusual size? I don't think they exist.
Oh, but they do exist here in California. They're called nutria. They're the size of small beavers. They're aquatic, and they're invading the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. They are a pest, and California wildlife officials are eager to find solutions for how to get rid of them.
They're very destructive in the sense that they destroy wetlands. They chew up the vegetation.
That's Peter Tira. He's an information officer for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and he says the whole issue began last spring when a nutria was found in central California.
California hadn't seen a nutria in more than 50 years. We believe the last feral population of nutria were eradicated from the state, from Los Angeles County, in fact, in 1965.
And they don't know how or why they got back here. The department is looking into eradication plans. Other states have already tried. In recent years, Maryland, for example, killed more than 14,000, I should say, nutria in the Chesapeake Bay. Other states, such as Louisiana, encourage their residents to eat nutria. That wouldn't be legal here in California as of now, but that might change.
So right now the law reads that you cannot possess nutria, cannot transport live nutria, those kinds of things. And they were all intended to prevent their introduction into the state. So now that they're here, that's one thing we're looking at, is whether the laws need to be changed or the regulations need to be looked at, to whether they would allow the trapping or hunting of nutria.
And Peter Tira also has this request for you.
We are asking folks to report any sightings or, pictures they take on their camera. If you're not sure, send in a photo or contact our invasive species program. Again, that's wildlife.ca.gov. And as we develop kind of action plans and get more information, we'll be sharing that with the public as well.
It's Peter Tira, information officer for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Coming up, a veritable banquet, of movies to talk about, including Ava DuVernay's big-budget Disney movie, A Wrinkle in Time. Some big names give, according to our critics, not exactly their greatest performances.
When she pushes herself, it's great. And this is like, I'm Oprah, but I'm dressed like a 90s club kid.
Reviews of A Wrinkle in Time and many other films, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and from Madeline Brand. The much-anticipated film rendition of A Wrinkle in Time is finally here, and it is time for film reviews. And here to talk about that movie and other new releases coming out this weekend, Christy Lemire, a film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube, and Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Happy Friday. All right, first up, the big one, of course, the film adaptation of the classic 1962 young adult fantasy novel, A Wrinkle in Time. It stars Storm Reid as Meg Murray, plus Oprah, of course, Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, Chris Pine, and here's a clip.
Where are we?
We heard a cry out in the universe.
father's alive.
We believe he is, and we're here to help you find him. We are in search of warriors.
Warriors who serve the good and the light in the universe.
You're kidding.
Do I look like I'm kidding? A little. I'm not.
That's a children's novel?
It's dark. I mean, scary right? stuff happens, as they often do in children's novels,
course,
yes.
Of course. But, I mean, this is the first film, and you hear it, right? You hear it in the clip. A big budget, $100 million to be directed by a woman of color, the first big budget film, Ava DuVernay. The cast is very diverse. What did you think of this one, Christine?
So I'm very mixed on this.
I
love the ambition of it, and I love that Ava got the keys to the kingdom, the magic kingdom, if you will. And I love the fact that she tries to balance this story that people have loved for many, many years with a modern sensibility, you know, reflected by the diverse cast. And, you know, the kids in this movie go to James Baldwin Middle School. And Mindy Kaling's character quotes everybody from Shakespeare to Outkast to Lin-Manuel Miranda in Spouting Pearls of Wisdom. Visually, it's very colorful. And it's very lively and it's very ambitious. Narratively, it's kind of a mess and it's really rushed and really compressed and it never achieves the emotion that it seeks. And you see all this talent on display and I like what she's trying here, but it just never comes together as a powerfully emotional experience.
Narratively kind of a mess, she says, Tim. So the plot, is it lacking something, do you think? What's going on here?
Well, I have to out myself. I haven't read the book. And so I only basing it on the movie. But, you know, in the movie, Meg, played by this newcomer Storm Reid, her father, who's an astrophysicist, played by Chris Pine, has been missing for 4 years. And most people think that he's dead, but she believes that he is not. And she's visited by these three sort of like celestial intergalactic beings played by Mindy Kaling and Reese Witherspoon and Oprah Winfrey. And they say, no, your father is not dead, but he has been held captive in this other realm. And as the clip explained, we're looking for warriors. Yeah. We need you to help us find and rescue your father. So I haven't read the book. I can only base it on the movie.
I wonder, though, if it's because you haven't read the book. Is that, what's going on? You didn't read it either.
My 8-year-old kid has read it, but I have not read it.
What did your 8-year-old kid have to say about it?
About the movie or the book?
About the movie.
He didn't love it either.
Really?
But he's a very discerning film goer for an 8-year-old. Like, my kid has seen Dunkirk.
Yeah. So it makes no difference whether you've read the book or not. Probably you don't think you're going to like the movie. Tim says he does like it.
I'm neither Christy nor her 8-year-old son, who is a lovely, and I love that kid. I actually liked it. I mean, I agree with Christy that it's a bit of a mess. But the two things I think that ultimately won me over for the movie is that, number one, I think she's very much trying to consciously make a old-fashioned live-action Disney movie. Mm-hmm. She's talked about, you know, Escape to Witch Mountain and Never-Ending Story and like that. And those movies were not necessarily great, but they were good. And they had this kind of like weird, funky energy to them. And I kind of responded to that in this movie as well. And the other thing that I also really liked is there is something incredibly moving about how sort of genuine and sincere it is in terms of its emotions. This movie is very much about this idea of the universe needs more goodness. And I think that DuVernay and her cast, for the most part, succeed in conveying that feeling. I find this sort of like
it's a nice feeling.
It's a nice feeling. Yeah. It's a big-hearted movie. It's got problems. It's got actors who I don't think who are way too cutesy. But I think Storm Reid is really good as the young middle school girl who's sort of like the main heroine of the film. And I think Chris Pine, as her father, is really good. He's been on kind of a roll lately between Wonder Woman and Into the Wild and now this. And so there is a lot of stuff that doesn't work, but there was enough stuff in this movie that did work that I would recommend.
I wonder if that feeling that Tim speaks of, Christy, is one that, you know, maybe the CGI, the effects get in the way. Do you think that's what's going on here?
Well, the effects make this really very much a kid's movie. I think a lot of movies try to aim for, you know, appealing to audiences of all ages. Tim mentioned the sweetness of it and the sincerity. It's really simplistic in a lot of ways. And it feels truly like it is aimed toward children. That's not a bad thing. And I love the fact that your heroine is a young woman of color who is brilliant with science, who uses her expertise to help save the day. And what's funny about this is that her sidekick, the kind of pretty, bland, nice kid who has a crush on her, is the role that a girl would ordinarily play in this kind of movie. He's along for the ride, and he's not very helpful, but he means well, and he's nice. This feels like it's really for kids. And I never forgot that I was watching Oprah, by the way. She is like giant floating Oprah, towering over everything, and she is saying all these kind of self-help-isms that you could imagine her saying on television. It's very on brand for Oprah. And I like Oprah when she actually pushes herself and acts in darker things like The Butler or Beloved.
Selma.
And but when she pushes herself, it's great. And this is like, I'm Oprah, but I'm dressed like a 90s club kid.
Unfortunately, three of the least good performances in the movie are all these aforementioned celestial beings. I found Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, and Oprah. I think Oprah's sort of the best because Oprah's like, hey, I'm Oprah. What do you want me to do? You know? And she kind of does her Oprah thing. I kind of enjoy that. But Mindy Kaling, who does basically like just spout different quotations, she's not so great. Reese Witherspoon, that character feels way too cutesy.
Let's move on to fewer big names in another movie called Thoroughbreds, starring some young adults, but maybe not suitable for most young people, about a couple of upper-class teenage girls. One of them has a very mean stepfather. Let's hear a clip.
I'm sending you to boarding school. After that, you're off my payroll.
You hate him. You despise him.
Honey, you can't go in looking like that.
I'm fine. Am I going to have to stand here all day like a robot repeating myself? I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine.
You ever think about just killing him?
How would you?
Wow, that's intense. Thoroughbreds. Wow. Sounds like they're hatching a plan, Christy.
Yes, I love this movie.
Really?
It is deliciously mean and impeccably crafted.
Like Heather's deliciously mean?
Really? Actually, it's a lot like Heather's. Yes, it has sort of the darkly funny bite of Heather's, but it has a tonal restraint and a structural rigidity that reminded me of the films of this Greek director, Yorgos Lanthimos, who made The Lobster and The Killing of a Sacred Deer and Dogtooth.
Yeah.
And the two actresses, Anya Taylor-Joy and Olivia Cooke, are so perfectly cast and perfectly calibrated because they are seemingly very different. Anya Taylor-Joy is wealthy and polished and preppy chic and put together. And Olivia Cooke is kind of a mess. And she has a scandal in her past. And they are childhood friends who reconnect. And they realize they have more in common than perhaps they initially thought. And it's the first movie from this young playwright named Corey Finley. He had never been on a film set before he made this movie, and he wrote and directed it, and it's so sharp, and you never know where it's going, and it's really beautifully shot, and it maybe wraps up a little neatly, but I dug it for a long time.
All right, the Christy Lemire stamp of approval right there for that one. From dark comedy to more, I guess, a political satire from Armando Iannucci, the creator of Veep, that's who we know him as, The Death of Stalin. It stars Steve Buscemi, Michael Palin of Monty Python fame, of course, Jeffrey Tambor. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I propose we call a doctor.
All the best doctors are dead.
I can't remember who's alive and who isn't.
It's Comrade Stalin.
I'll take it from here.
We need to start putting together a plan.
How can you run and plot at the same time?
We should get Stalin's children here.
What are you doing to my father, you jackals?
You jackals. This is Moscow, 1953, the brutal dictator Joseph Stalin, who was responsible for millions of deaths, dies suddenly of a stroke. So this is a super, super dark comedy. How is it funny in any way?
It's funny because it's Iannucci and because you know him from Veep and The Thick of It and In the Loop and all of that. You sort of know what kind of style of comedy that he does so well, and that style is used in this movie, which actually is based on a graphic novel that came out, I think, like 6 or 8 months ago. And it is funny and is sharp, but I would say that, and I don't mean this as a criticism.
The subject matter is not funny.
Well, this is actually the least funny of his movies, and I don't mean that as a criticism because this is a pretty dark movie. And especially what I think is effective in this film is this idea that everything that the characters are doing in terms of their plotting and their scheming and who's going to basically assume the throne now that Stalin is dead, they elect Jeffrey Tambor's character, but nobody really wants Tambor's character to run the show and they're all kind of scheming behind his back. Everything that happens, everything that they're doing, you realize has a real-world effect there in the Soviet Union. And there's such a sense of all these people in power who are so incredibly callous and horrible, who are inflicting all of this damage and terror on the people that they're supposed to be serving. And so while the movie is funny, a lot of those laughs kind of get caught in your throat, to be perfectly honest.
And Iannucci actually said that this could be something that happens right now. It's very timely.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and everybody there really could see the real world, modern day parallels. And, you know, and this Death of Stalin kind of leans into that. They want you to think about what's happening right now, kind of across the globe. It's funny. It's difficult to watch at certain times because you think, this is 65 right. years ago, but it could be yesterday.
Well, it could be, I mean, something like Inglourious Basterds, right? Like, that movie was sort of a, you know, I mean, it obviously the subject matter was very unfunny, but it was also a Quentin Tarantino, right? It was...
Well, I think with this movie especially...
Yeah, the absurdity of it.
Yeah, I think also this idea is people in power are always horrible, and they will do whatever it takes to destroy other people in power, and they don't care about anybody that they step on along the way. It's impossible to watch this movie in 2018 and not think about the modern day parallels to that.
So from dark comedy to really dark comedy to another dark comedy, Gringo stars Charlize Theron, Joel Edgerton, David Oyelowo. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Medical marijuana is already a multi-billion dollar industry. The future is this weed pill.
I'm still not sure about this.
Look, most people will tell you Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, but even a complete idiot will tell you Neil Armstrong did it first. And do you know why he went first?
He was the mission
hatch opened on his
because
side.
He pushed Buzz Aldrin out of the way.
Pushed him out of the way, she says. All right, Christy, who does Charlize Theron want to push out of the way? What's going on here?
Everybody.
She's pushing everybody out of the way.
Yeah, pretty much. So this is an amazing cast. As you mentioned, we have Charlize Theron and we have David Oyelowo.
And the brother of the director.
So yes, conveniently enough. And it's all these awful people, and they all go to Mexico for this drug, this miracle drug, and then there are some random other people who are there to be drug mules, and they all got caught up with each other, and David Oyelowo is the nice guy in the middle who just wants to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And this is just mean, and like not even mean in a funny way. We talked about Thoroughbreds a little bit ago and how smart and sharp and mean that is. This is just flatly mean, and these people are just awful. It's awful people doing awful things to each other for nearly 2 hours, and it's so long. No one's redeemable here. I kind of hated this movie.
I mean, is being mean, though, does a mean people make for a mean movie, a bad movie?
If there's a point to it, if there's like, you know, a foundation to it, satire, if it's trying to skewer somebody, it's like what people, there's corporate greed in the world and that makes people terrible. And I don't know how novel that is as a concept to explore.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't hate it quite as much, but I didn't like this. I mean, Death of Stalin.
Were they really that mean?
Well, Death of Stalin...
Is Christy overselling the mean?
No, she's not. Because with Death of Stalin, those people are all bastards, right? But this thing that's compelling and interesting and that those characters are funny. The problem with Gringo is that Gringo is one of those unfortunate movies that just carries this air of, man, aren't we doing a great dark comedy? This is pretty bleak. Do you want jokes about, you know, overweight people and the deaf to show how like edgy we are? You got it. Like, it's that type of movie. It carries this badge of honor about how kind of dark and subversive it is. But the story's not that interesting, which is unfortunate because Oyelowo, I think, is actually really good in this as he's like the patsy, essentially. He's kind of fun. Theron's really great. I think she's the only actor in the entire thing who I think kind of gets the jet black comic tone of this movie. The rest of it is pretty tedious.
Yeah, and Charlize finds inspired avenues into that meanness.
Yeah.
Whereas nobody else really does.
Yeah.
Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, we've been playing some Notorious B.I.G. for you on today's show. Maybe you've noticed. Christopher Wallace, a.k.a. Biggie Smalls, was shot and killed here in Los Angeles 21 years ago today. It's been so long ago. And it is a homicide that remains unsolved. So, in homage, R.I.P. Biggie Smalls. Coming up... Well, here's something that will add to the freeway rivalry here in Southern California. A swing and a miss for the Dodgers, who lost an ace player to the Angels. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiatakis, sitting in for Madeline Brand, or as you could say, pinch hitting. In Major League Baseball, an intense feeding frenzy recently ended, with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim coming out on top. The Angels signed the young Japanese star Shohei Ohtani. Ohtani is Japan's best pitcher. He is also Japan's best hitter. Yes, Ohtani is a very rare breed, and he is both a pitching ace and a slugging batter. Of course, the most famous example of someone doing both of those things in the pros is Babe Ruth, the old Bambino. Seven teams, including the Dodgers, went all out to land the Japanese star, but the Angels pulled the longest straw, and the 23-year-old Ohtani has already pitched and hit for the team in some preseason games. Here to tell us more on this new rivalry, Matt Money Smith is co-host of the Petros and Money Show here in L.A. on KLAC 570 AM. Hello, Matt.
Hi. We might actually have ourselves a little rivalry.
Yeah, what's going on here? What, I mean, kind of like the public radio sports radio rivalry. This sounds like pretty intense, right? Tell us about Shohei.
Kind of let it be known that he was going to turn down the opportunity to make tens of millions of dollars to come to the major leagues a little bit early. Had he waited a couple years, he would have been able to sign a much larger, more lucrative deal, where teams would have to decide, all right, how much do we really want to pay someone that we don't quite know how his skills will transfer. Instead, he comes over younger, and just not to get too deep into the rules, this is one of the more affordable, if you believe he'll pan out, superstars, the most affordable superstar in a league that tends to pay guys that are really good somewhere north of $30 million a year. He's getting about, 7% of that this season for the Angels. So it was a big deal when teams found out he was going to come over. He was interviewing his potential employers. Two of them happened to be the Dodgers and the Angels. And the Angels ultimately won in that little exercise. And the Dodgers were pretty upset because Clayton Kershaw was called away from his own anniversary, Justin Turner away from planning for his anniversary to sit with Ohtani, pitch the Dodgers. And they both walked out of that room saying he's never going to play in the National League because he's going to have to be a designated hitter.
Right.
And we just wasted our time. So they do not like Ohtani very much.
They were annoyed, like flat out annoyed, right? Because they took so much time out of their schedules.
Yeah, I mean, they said, look, if he would have ultimately decided and we thought that he was legitimately listening to us and weighing the options of becoming a Dodger, then fine. But they said it was clear from the start. You know, when they asked him about playing the field, what position do you think he would play? He hasn't played in the field since high school. I mean, it was never a reality. And that he went through this song and dance with a few different NL teams, the Giants, the Dodgers. Ultimately, it seemed as though it probably came down to the Mariners and Angels, and there was no need for them to waste their time.
And Ohtani faced off against Kershaw, right? They played against one another. What happened?
Oh, Kershaw gave him the old patented Kershaw curveball that froze him, and he went down looking. And when asked after the game, Kershaw, as you know, many people here in LA know, he is not. I don't want to say he's not a dynamic personality. He's just not very forthcoming with his emotions. He is kind of more of your standard cliche riddled post game interview.
He's from Texas, isn't he?
He's from Texas, yeah, the Dallas area. He's very nice. He's been on the show with us a number of times, and he's always been very nice. But he's also, again, just not very giving with his emotions or answers. So when he was asked about striking out Ohtani, and he actually got a little loose and said, whatever with that guy, you know, we're done. He didn't listen to our pitch, so I don't care. He can do whatever he wants.
So
I mean, it was pretty great.
I'll throw him a curveball. How about that? Yeah,
it was pretty great.
All right, well, he didn't do so well at home plate, right, at the batter's box, as it were. But can he pitch and bat in the same game? He can do that in the American League, right?
He can if they opt to have somebody else be the DH and DH for one of the position players. I don't get the sense they'll do that. I mean, they may because, you know, you don't have to have a DH, I guess. If you don't want, you can list him as the DH and the pitcher. So technically, yes, he could do both in the same game. Obviously, he would have to do that were he in a National League parks, like any American League pitcher. But it's funny, you know, we're doing this, we're having this conversation today. He just got done pitching for the Angels against the Tijuana Toros, a professional team from Mexico, and he got absolutely lit up. I mean, I think he gave up 6 runs, 6 hits in just a couple innings, and his spring has not gone very well. But that's, you know, it's to be expected. He's making a transition. He doesn't know any of the hitters. I guess not very many people know the Tijuana Toros hitters as it is. But it could probably be going a lot better for Ohtani right now, especially considering the attention, not just here, but of course we know what it looks like with the Japanese media when they have one of their stars come over to play Major League Baseball.
And the Dodgers know about that, by the way, an ace pitcher in a big game.
Yes. Who, don't they ever.
Who didn't do quite as well as was intentioned. Babe Ruth, obviously the Bambino, is an example, Matt, everyone points to of someone who pitched and batted in the majors. Are there other examples of somebody who did both really well?
No.
That's it.
Truly is. Yeah, it is the last time that it happened. I mean, we've had pitchers convert, you know, like Rick Ankiel was a pitcher for the Cardinals. For whatever reason, his control got away from him. They ended up shifting him to be an outfielder, and he did okay. Didn't do great. I mean, he was a really good young pitcher before whatever. And he had some, you know, he had some emotional issues. He kind of lost his, I guess, mental focus and was really struggling with his control and pressure on the mound. So they moved him to the outfield. He became a hitter, and he was all right. That's the last, I think, kind of player I can think of. You know, Kenley Jansen was a catcher in the minor leagues before he became the best closer in baseball. So you've had people shift, you know, from a hitter and a position player to a pitcher and vice versa, but never one who was trying to do it in the same season.
How are the Angels and Dodgers looking in the preseason, by the way, before we let you go?
Yeah, they both look good. You know, the Dodgers, again, look like if they're not in the World Series, they'll at least be in the postseason tournament to get there. They really did not change much in the offseason. Brought pretty much everyone back that made it to the seventh game of the World Series. Save Yu Darvish, who was with them, you know, for the second half of the season. And I think before people maybe freak out about the rotation, you know, they're willing to make deals at the deadline. And they still have a lot of young players in their minor league system that if, you know, an ace becomes available at the end of July, like they have just about every year when they did with Rich Hill 2 years ago and Yu Darvish last year, they'll make that move again. So kind of knowing that that's out there, this does look to be the best team in the National League. As for the Angels, you know, they made a lot of moves, and they upgraded. You know, they desperately needed to upgrade that rotation. The interesting thing for the Angels is with the addition of Ohtani, you know, they're going to try to become one of the first Major League Baseball teams that shifts to, you know, a six-man rotation. And not to get too baseball-y, but, you know, most baseball teams have, and by most, they all have five starting pitchers.
They all do.
Yeah, they pitch every fifth day. Now, Jim Tracy, when he was in Colorado, did something interesting where he did not pitch any of his starters past 4 innings to try to help them out in terms of keep them healthy for the entire season. That did not work well, which is why he's no longer their manager.
Matt Money Smith, co-host of the Petros and Money Show on AM 570 here in L.A. Matt, have a great weekend.
All right, you too. Thanks so much.
And it's feedback time, and our friend Christian Bordahl, our sports correspondent, is here.
How's
What's
it going?
Well,
yesterday, you may remember, we talked about this.
President Trump is hosting a meeting today about video games and violence.
Yes, he met with the game producers, talked about the connection between video games and violence. We had a lot of feedback from our listeners on that issue, so I just wanted to touch on a couple of those things. Sean Panzer says, actually, video games promote problem-solving, quick reflexes, and team-building, not being afraid to fail. Jennifer Jones said, video games are a lot more than just violence these days. They're highly social, they have storylines, puzzles. Adam Badluto spoke for a lot of people when he pointed out that other punk countries play the same video games, and yet they don't have these mass shootings. Gachapunkai said, I've been playing violent video games all my life. I'm 32 now, and people tell me I'm too nice.
You are too nice, Christian. You are too nice.
So I put up a Twitter poll. What do you think? Do violent video games lead to more violence in the real world? 15% said yes. 29% said no. They dehumanize and coarsen. No said 51%. And 5% said I don't know.
Thanks to everyone. It's been a blast. Have a great weekend.